From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And here's a local news report from 2011.
This year, the average Thanksgiving dinner will cost $49.20. That's almost $6 more than last year.
And here's another from 2012.
Last year, a turkey dinner for 10 people cost $49.20. This year, that price is climbing nearly 30 cents to $49.48.
And this year,
according to a recent survey, it will be just over $50 to feed a family of 10. That's a roughly $3 increase over Thanksgiving of 2012.
We all have our Thanksgiving traditions, and for the news media, it seems to be the annual reporting on the rising cost of Thanksgiving dinner. And according to the Columbia Journalism Review's Ryan Chittum, this is one tradition journalists traditionally screw up. Ryan, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
So reporters across the country aren't actually going out on their own each year to investigate the costs of a Thanksgiving dinner. Instead, they all basically get the same press release, right?
It's true. The American Farm Bureau Federation puts out this release every year a couple of weeks before Thanksgiving. They go and average what a turkey costs across the country, and they look at cranberries, and they look at stuffing and, you know, potatoes. They come up with a basket of about a dozen ingredients, add it all up, and say this is what it would take to feed 10 people on Thanksgiving, and the press dutifully snaps it up.
And yet, even though everyone is working off that same Farm Bureau press release, you say that different outlets use the information to different ends. How so?
I guess it was a couple of years ago I noticed the Wall Street Journal editorial page doing a report that used this survey to hype, you know, runaway inflation. The Wall Street Journal editorial page, they have a hard money stance. So they're looking for signs of inflation everywhere, and they found it in a single data point from the Farm Bureau.
You also say that the information isn't just sculpted by ideologues, that the mainstream press also distorts the Farm Bureau's findings, but for different reasons.
The press is looking for conflict, it's looking for tension, and reporters and editors, they want an angle that stimulates the reader, and I've got to read this, and outrages the reader. If you write, Thanksgiving bill is the same as last year or doesn't move much, that's not going to grab attention.
And so last year, when Thanksgiving dinner prices were up 28 cents, reporters still found a way to ratchet up that tension.
Right. CNBC ran a story that said turkey prices gobble up more of Thanksgiving bill. So that's what I'm talking about when I say reporters looking for tension.
Whether you want to hype inflation or just hype the importance of your story, you're distorting the findings for a reason. But sometimes it happens for no reason.
Right. I mean, it's kind of an old saw that journalists aren't very good at math. And I noticed a couple of just plain old math errors. CNBC saying the price of Thanksgiving dinner rose 3% when it was really 0.6%. And they didn't adjust for inflation, which they should have. And when you do that, you find out that the cost of Thanksgiving dinner fell 1.4%. And backing up a bit, just the idea that the Thanksgiving dinner is an important indicator of prices is fundamentally flawed.
If you use oil prices, you might have something that indicates something real.
Right. Oil prices are one of the fundamental building blocks of the economy, but turkey prices aren't. So the turkey price makes for a good headline, but as an indicator of the wider economy, it's a poor stand-in.
I wonder how the media can handle it when the costs aren't actually going up like this year. I mean, should we expect a raft of stories that we're in a big deflationary spiral?
No. And I think the press is biased towards seeing price increases. That's just the psychological blind spot that most of us have. So I saw the Los Angeles Times say that the Thanksgiving dinner cost falls from last year's record to $49.04. They frame it as still being relatively high, at least, because last year was a record. When in fact, if you look at the actual numbers and you adjust for inflation, which you have to, last year wasn't a record at all. It was $12 less than it was in 1986 in real terms. When Straight News gets it wrong, I think it's just like, you know, this is an easy story. We're going to slap it together, sex it up a little bit. And we also don't know how to do math. So when you combine those things, you have a toxic stew.
Yuck. So that's why you hate Thanksgiving.
It's my favorite holiday, I've got to say.
Ryan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Chittum reports on the business press for the Columbia Journalism Review.
Many an investigative story sets off explosive reactions, and such was the case with a Bloomberg News inquiry into the personal wealth accumulated by China's ruling elites. The past 2 weeks have seen accusations, denials, and a flurry of sudden personnel moves that had all the appearance of heads rolling. Except the drama wasn't taking place within the Chinese government or Communist Party. It's happening at Bloomberg, where the article originated and where it remains today unseen by the outside world. Yes, the piece by Michael Forsyth and Shai Oster was never published, leading to a journalistic scandal and the suggestion that Bloomberg editor-in-chief Matthew Winkler was pulling punches to protect the company's business interests in China. The company has said such a characterization is absurd, and Winkler insists the stories remain active. But leaks of internal Bloomberg deliberations suggest otherwise. And the whole affair suggests the fears of a Chinese crackdown on journalism no longer center on Tibet or Falun Gong. Edward Wong from the New York Times says the new red line is scrutiny of private wealth.
The reason why this became such a big issue last year was because a couple of news organizations decided to devote business reporters, reporters who are used to combing through financial documents to really ferret out actual hard numbers and asset locations of these families. And it highlights the increasing gap between ordinary people here in China and the very elite who are running China. This isn't an image of China that the party wants the world to see.
Before we get to the Bloomberg particulars, just please give me a sense of what you and your colleagues face in the ordinary course of doing business, trying to cover China.
We're seeing them using very harsh tactics to try and keep us under control. Last year, a couple of news organizations, including Bloomberg and the New York Times, did investigative financial stories that looked at the assets of various Chinese leaders. And the measures that the government's taken in retaliation are immense. They've blocked their websites here in China. They're holding up visas for new journalists who are trying to come in.
Now, what complicates this story is that Bloomberg has one set of interests, journalistic, and a second set of interests in China, commercial, because the goose that lays the Bloomberg golden egg is Wall Street data. And there's some question as to whether infuriating the Chinese government with its news reporting will cost them business in the data sector. Is that a fair concern?
I don't think it's even a question. It's a fact. When they published their first story last year on the family wealth of Xi Jinping, who's now the party chief here, officials ordered state-owned enterprises to drop terminal subscriptions. They were coming up to another story this year, but also about wealth and elite party families. In a conference call with New York on October 29th, they got a message from the editor-in-chief, Matthew Winkler, that if they ran the story, then they would get kicked out of China. He was saying, oh, we have to stay in China to cover China. And he compared the situation to foreign journalists working under Nazi Germany when they would have to engage in some forms of self-censorship to maintain access. The other people we've spoken to at Bloomberg in New York say that no one on the business side talked to the editorial side before this story ran, but we do know that the business side in China has come under great pressure.
Winkler says the story wasn't spiked, but the leaks that are coming out of Bloomberg in the ensuing 2 weeks tell a very different story.
That's correct. The emails are some of the more interesting documentary evidence that have come out during the story. I mean, they were first printed by Financial Times, and they showed one editor saying, oh, the story's terrific. The top editor working on the story said it's almost there. And also, our sources say that the story had been vetted by a lawyer in early October, which is usually something that any news organization has done in the very final stages. All the signals to everyone was that the story was at the end stage and it would be ready to run very soon. Then suddenly, there's a moment of silence when no one hears from the editors in mid-October, and then in late October, they get a series of conference calls telling them the story was being held, was being put on the back burner, or was being killed, depending on whose version of the story you hear.
What do you think happened to that story?
I would say that from talks with our sources, it seems that the story was, at the very least, it was put on the back burner. Like, that term was used. But the message that people took out of those conference calls is that for now the story was dead and would not be moving forward.
If you take the most sinister view of what's taken place, it sure looks like Bloomberg has behaved in, you know, a craven, gun-shy, pusillanimous way to protect its business interests. That's how it looks. But I'm curious, does a company like Bloomberg or the New York Times or Reuters or anybody else who has to do business in China have any leverage over the Chinese government? Is there nothing that Western journalists have to offer that China dare not lose?
Well, I think that China does want coverage of the country, of the growing economy, of the people here, of its leaders, and that's part of its need for soft power in the world and for the world to understand it. So I don't think it wants the major news bureaus to pull up their stakes and leave. That's not what they're trying to get at. And so because of that, I do believe these organizations have some leverage over China. Ones like Bloomberg or Thomson Reuters have another avenue of leverage in that Chinese state banks need their terminals to do business. Altogether, these organizations do have ways of pushing back against bullying from the Chinese government.
Edward, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Edward Wong covers China from Beijing for the New York Times.
Coming up, anxiety over surveillance has Americans filing FOIAs in droves.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from Next Issue, providing unlimited access to popular magazines like The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, Time, People, Wired, New York Magazine, Vanity Fair, and over 100 more, all for a single price. Listeners can read as much as they want, all in one convenient app, and can try 1 month free at nextissue.com/media. The New School, offering graduate programs in media studies and media management. These flexible cross-disciplinary programs are designed to carefully balance theory and practice so students are fully engaged with current media scholarship, as well as the latest tools of media production and management. The programs can be completed on campus in New York City, online, or in a combination of on-campus and online study. More information about the New School's graduate programs in media studies and media management is available at newschool.edu/media NYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's now been over 5 months since the first bombshell report in June about the U.S. government's surveillance apparatus, based on leaks from the government contractor Edward Snowden. Over those months, the NSA has tried to assuage public anxiety by releasing information, including a heap of documents this week. But for many Americans, those releases just aren't enough. The Snowden leaks touched off a flood of personal requests for NSA documents that Pamela Phillips, the chief of the NSA Freedom of Information Act and Privacy Act office, says her office can't keep up with. Apparently, the increase in FOIA requests from the first quarter of the fiscal year to the last is up over 800%.
In fiscal year 2012, over 1,800 requests. And then for fiscal year 2013, we received over 4,300 FOIA requests, most of those coming in after the 6th of June.
You have a 19-person staff, right?
Yes, ma'am.
How backed up are you?
We are very backed up. We are doing our best to respond to all requesters within 20 days as required by law, at least to let them know we've received the request, what their case number is, what we're doing with the request. And for many of those, we can answer right off the bat.
I got the impression that your answer to most of these requests was no.
For those individuals who are looking for intelligence on themselves, the answer essentially is we can't tell you whether we do or don't have intelligence information on you. This agency has had this position long before the media leaks over the summer. If we were to confirm or deny the existence of intelligence records in response to any one of these individuals, we would have to do the same for all individuals making those similar requests. And that would allow, for instance, a terrorist contemplating an attack, they could file that type of a request to try to determine whether they were under surveillance. they would be able to determine whether they've successfully evaded detection. And that's not an acceptable risk when we're looking at the lives and security of Americans.
So what theoretically could you provide?
If you look at the Office of Director of National Intelligence website, there have been several significant releases recently of our collection information regarding the programs themselves. Again, that's information about how the programs work, the authorities, the oversight, but it's not information on specific targets or intelligence interest. Those are the things that we have to continue to be consistent and protect.
Now, a recent USA Today article quotes Anne Weissman, who is the chief counsel at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW.
Yes.
And she said that people are legitimately troubled by the idea that the government is monitoring and collecting information about their email traffic, phone calls, and who knows what else. And that, she said, there's a growing sense of horror every time there's a new report about this data. I mean, I know you don't make the policy, but you do concede that these programs represent, for many people, a serious breach of trust.
I understand that individuals are concerned and want to understand what we're doing. And the type of information that's getting released is information that we're hoping will raise awareness and encourage public dialogue about the programs. But again, when it comes to what specific information we've collected on any specific individual, we still cannot confirm or deny that information.
Is there any possibility that those in charge might change their mind about the idea that letting people in on what's being collected about them will harm ongoing intelligence operations?
I'm not aware of anything that would be changing that position.
So, really, for people who are disturbed about this kind of intelligence gathering, you go to Congress and you say, my constituents want this done differently, if, in fact, enough of the public cares enough about it to do it. But they're not going to be able to get anything about themselves from the NSA.
Believe me, we understand that it's frustrating to people. My office prides itself on being responsive. This FOIA office has been very responsive to individuals in the past on all kinds of requests for information. This is frustrating. It's frustrating for my staff that so many people are upset. And they're upset with the FOIA office, even though we're not the ones doing any of the mission. We're just trying to give the best response we can within the time constraints that we have.
Pamela, thank you very much for making yourself available.
Oh, you're welcome.
Pamela Phillips is the chief of the NSA Freedom of Information Act and Privacy Act office.
Penn American Center, a writers' organization, released a report last week titled Chilling Effects, NSA Surveillance Drives U.S. Writers to Self-Censor. Of the 500-plus members surveyed, 28% said they've curtailed or avoided social media activities. 24% have deliberately avoided certain topics in phone or email conversations. 13% have taken extra steps to disguise or cover their digital footprints. The gathering sense of nervousness is nerve-wracking in itself. What does freedom of expression really mean if our thinkers are constantly looking over their shoulders? But at least one commentator draws a different lesson from the report. L.A. Times book critic David Yulin wrote a piece telling writers to just grow a pair and get busy.
Given the value of free expression of ideas to what we do for a living, writers should be on the front line of pushing back against the surveillance rather than allowing it to sort of stifle their own expression.
You invoked some pretty big names in the history of American dissidents, right at the top of the list being Thomas Paine. How does he figure in?
You could make the argument that Common Sense is the most important book ever published in the United States, or even before the United States, because it's really the spark plug from which the Declaration of Independence grew, from which the independence movement really gelled. Paine had to publish that book anonymously in January of 1776 because it was considered treasonous by the British authorities. If they had caught up with him, he would have been likely to have been put to death. He, to me, has always been a role model of what the engaged writer ought to be.
You mentioned Harriet Beecher Stowe as well.
Uncle Tom's Cabin, when it came out in the 1850s, really helped catalyze the abolitionist movement. She was a writer who saw her role not only as a creative role, but also as a social role. And I think that this is something that has been a long tradition in American literature and American letters. We've often had writers who have considered themselves either public figures or public commentators. I think of a writer like Norman Mailer. I think of a writer like Joan Didion. I think of contemporary writer like Jonathan Lethem, writers who are engaged in the process of the culture. And I think that that's a really important role for writers to fulfill.
All right, got that. I also took note of your concerns about NSA surveillance and the government's overstepping in the name of national security. And yet, you cannot read your piece but to come away with the idea that you believe really the onus is on the writers to say what they have to say irrespective of the political or intelligence conditions that they're living in.
In the piece, I talk about Václav Havel and his notion of the second culture, which he developed when he was living behind the Iron Curtain in Czechoslovakia. And the basic idea is that freedom doesn't come from without, it comes from within. And that by behaving as if one is free, one becomes free. So in Havel's case, you know, you vote in the elections, even though you know they're a sham. You write what you're going to write, you put on the plays that you want to put on, even though you know that they could create trouble for you. In Havel's case, it involved prison time at various points. The key there is they only own you if they own your mind. You have a choice, I think, of either backing away or engaging, and I've always considered writing to be an act or an art of engagement.
Now, I should say that the Penn study seems to get less to what authors write than the way they speak on the phone, the way they communicate by email, the way they behave in social media. Do you think it demonstrates implicitly that similar cautions and pulled punches are going on in the writing itself?
The Penn study quotes some specific writers saying, I backed away from certain kinds of projects because I was concerned about what kind of red flag words might come up in terms of Google searches and so forth. I think there is a need for people, not just writers, but all of us, to be aware that when we're using social media, when we're using email, that we are, in a very real sense, publishing. We are having a public conversation. I'm not surprised at all that the NSA is trying to gather as much information about us as it can through monitoring digital transmissions and digital technology. That's what the NSA is designed to do. But I do think that caution breeds caution, and that one of the things that great writing requires is a little bit of a sense of recklessness on a writer's part. You really have to be willing to go for it and to push the boundaries of your idea, of your story, of your characters, of your revelation. Once you get into a territory where caution becomes the common currency, then I think people just generally back away from things that they might feel are risky, whereas they might not otherwise.
When you saw the Penn numbers, did you go, aha, aha, this corroborates this sense I've had that the writing that I'm seeing, the books that are crossing my desk, have been, in the aggregate, half-hearted, fearful, or weak?
There are all sorts of books that come across one's desk. A lot of the books that I'm seeing are as rigorous and courageous and provocative as any books that I've been seeing over the years. I also think this is relatively new. You know, the NSA revelations are fairly recent. It takes a long time for books to get written. It takes a long time for books to get to market. If there is an effect, I don't know that we would see it at the moment. But to answer your question, no, I have not seen any kind of noticeable drop-off in books that are provocative, daring, exciting, etc.
Well, here's hoping. David, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
David Ulan is book critic for the Los Angeles Times.
In the rest of the hour, we'll consider how information travels in each era and across time. And we'll start with the publishing event. The Gutenberg Bible, printed almost 600 years ago. Even now, the Bible sells roughly 25 million each year in America alone. And the media have certainly influenced the understanding of the events captured therein.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep.
That was a clip from the year's most viewed TV series, the History Channel's miniseries on the Bible. At some point, almost 100 million people tuned in. So why does the American Bible Society conclude that fewer Americans read it or view it as sacred? Author Thomas Larson wrote recently in the magazine Guernica about what might be in store for the Bible as it enters the digital age. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You wondered whether consuming it on screen mutes the holiness of the Bible.
Let's take that word holy first. I sort of put quotes around that word because it implies that it cannot be judged. What I really mean is that holiness is really a matter of physicality. The fullest human expression comes about through shared oral language. And this is what gives it its holiness, the fact that so many millions, if not billions of people, have handled this language.
Is that enhanced or diminished by consuming it on your phone? And would that be true of any text?
Yeah. I mean, even the great secular books are being desacralized by their transmission into film, video, internet, etc. They're things that are passed through the oral tradition. And if you have less of an oral tradition, even if they make movies and audible versions of the Bible, that's not the same as actual people reading it aloud and talking about it in small groups. I think that is crucial, that when the book loses its felt intimacy in the sense that the Bible has, you know, been pawed and thumbed and carried around and backpacked among the soldiers on D-Day, once you start to lose that sense that you can have faith via a physical object, I think something's going to radically change.
There are active communities online that can share it. And of course, the use of these apps, 100 million people, would suggest that people are communally consuming the Bible.
This notion that we share things through social media doesn't mean they are felt in the body. Just because your eyes glance over a text, that doesn't mean you have an intimate relationship with it. You know, giving someone a Bible for confirmation is not like giving them an iPod where you can swipe the screen and read Leviticus. It just doesn't seem to have that fleshy connection. My attendance with literature is in the flesh. It's in the voice. I want it to speak as it always has spoken. I'm worried about where it's headed. And the Bible is a great example. The fact that our language that comes through our literature will be muted by the digital age.
I just wonder whether you may be a trifle premature. The online world offers endless opportunities that can make this kind of relationship with the Bible more communal.
It's important to remember that the way you believe is to speak back what is told to you. Without that physical exchange, I think the outreach of a religion is going to have to change. I don't know if it can be done digitally. I know Christians are trying to do it digitally, but they've always responded to new media. That's what the King James Version of the Bible is, a mass-produced book that would get the message out.
If you're using the Bible as an example of how the current digital age could deprive our great texts of their power, what do you think is likely to happen?
One of my ideas is that whatever it is we're talking about today, that will become literature. Not in the sense that we venerate it, but in the sense that technology will force us to communicate immediately. Talk will rule. The written text will not. Perhaps this will be far into the future, but I think the purveyors of the Bible will have to figure out how they can transform a text back into oral speech as it used to be.
Wow. That sounds almost apocalyptic. You predict this even at a moment when more people, especially young people, are writing more than they ever did in the pre-digital age.
Yeah, the age we live in is a field of flowers that are all blooming at the same time. There is, via technology, a transformation of the expressive arts. Is this a radical change from what we were? I sure hope so, because I think it may make the world more believable through actual experience, rather than a set of beliefs given to us from these so-called sacred texts.
So what you're saying is that this is a good thing, not a bad thing.
Well, I have to have hope, you know. We don't know where the future is going. We live in the moment. We don't live in this utopian past that when we die will exist again. This new realm is where people live. How's the Bible going to play into that new realm if the old texts really don't have anything to say in the new contexts? So there's hope that a kind of democracy will arise in place of the power of the book. That's what I'm saying.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, and I've enjoyed it.
Thomas Larson is the author of a monthly series on the social author at Guernica.
Why is this happening to me?
It's okay, bud. It's just from the medicine. Okay?
Is this going to be forever?
No, it won't be forever.
A dad films his drugged-up son after a trip to the dentist, and within days, the whole world knows about it. It was the epitome of going viral, and clearly, virality is a condition of the internet age. Or is it? Using a new database of 40,000 copies of antebellum newspapers, researchers at Northeastern University have found a similar, albeit slower, analog to virality in the 19th century. Ryan Cordell teaches at Northeastern. Ryan, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So there was a kind of proto-BuzzFeed in the form of daily newspapers. How do you figure?
Newspapers were an all-purpose medium. They printed poetry, travel narratives, how-to articles. For a lot of readers, they were their one portal to all kinds of information. And before copyright law, things got reprinted widely from newspaper to newspaper and changed along the way.
Before the Civil War, there wasn't even a telegraph, much less wire services. So what was the mechanism for a paper in Kentucky to run a story that had previously appeared in, let's say, New York?
It was free or very cheap for one newspaper to get other newspapers through the mail. Some larger newspapers actually hired someone called an exchanges editor whose entire job was to comb through other newspapers and find content to reprint. They would clip these articles out and they would organize them into drawers often by column length. And then when they were composing the newspaper and they needed something to fill 4 inches, they would open that 4-inch drawer and then they would set it and put it in their paper. They would add or take away a little bit of content in order to make them fit.
You use as an epigraph in your study a quote from Tocqueville, "Nothing but a newspaper can drop the same thought into 1,000 minds at the same moment." Give me an example of the same thought. What kind of stories went proto-viral in the 19th century?
There was plenty of political content. When James Buchanan gives his State of the Union address, it gets widely reprinted and quite quickly. And I should say very quickly in the 19th century means over the course of several months. There are other stories that spread over many years. Some of them are how-to articles. There's a popular article that just describes all of the different weights of different materials for a bushel. And it was printed mostly in rural newspapers for people who were exchanging commodities and needed to know that they were getting a fair deal. In good internet fashion, there are lots of lists that go very viral. And then there's a lot of poetry. It was very common in 19th century newspapers. And in some ways, I think it's like posting a song on YouTube. And there are lots of those.
One of the more fascinating stories that bubbled up was about the French sewer system.
Indeed, yeah. A lot of these stories really inhabit this place between truth and fiction, which again reminds me quite a bit of things that you'll see reposted on Facebook today. It's an account supposedly written by a Swedish correspondent of his journey through the sewer system of Paris on a flat-bottomed boat. And he's sort of waxing eloquent about the incredible feat that is this sewer system. This is a time when a lot of cities are beginning these massive public works projects to improve sanitation. So perhaps it's not surprising that people were fascinated by this experimental new public works project spearheaded by Napoleon.
Now, you found these nuggets in 41,829 issues of 132 pre-Civil War papers and coded them according to content. What's the fundamental goal of the project?
I'm working with a colleague of mine, David Smith, who's a computer scientist, looking for patterns to see the way that things spread across the country, the way that different kinds of stories moved, and to see which newspapers were printing the things that the most other newspapers were reprinting.
So when a story that's a recipe for making starch with gum arabic or the reprinting of Washington's farewell address, when you see those things emerge in paper after paper after paper, are there any conclusions you can draw that might otherwise not be accessible to you?
I'm a scholar of literature, and we tend to focus on, you know, these big novels, things like Moby Dick or The Scarlet Letter or Uncle Tom's Cabin. And you can learn a lot about readers by looking at those artifacts. But these everyday things that people not only read but felt a desire to share. People clipped these out of their newspapers and they compiled them in scrapbooks, which was a common practice during the time. It gives us this window into the priorities, the concerns, the desires of everyday readers that I think is hard to get at sometimes through these more canonical texts.
Ryan, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Ryan Cordell is an assistant professor of English at Northeastern University.
Coming up, how a tragedy transformed broadcast television.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. So as we consider how information has traveled from the Gutenberg press to 19th century newspapers, let's consider the era of broadcast TV. In television's younger days, going live was extremely difficult, costly, and rare. But 50 years ago, a monumental tragedy made live coverage essential, no matter the cost, whenever a president left the White House. We first aired this piece, one of our favorites, in 2003. In it, WNYC's Sarah Fischko recollects those dreadful days in November when everyone was paralyzed in front of the small screen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Conductor Eric Leinsdorf, Symphony Hall, Boston, November 22, 1963.
We have a press report over the wires that the President of the United States has been the victim of an assassination.
If you were alive and over, say, 5 years old in November 1963, wherever you were, you remember it.
We will play the funeral march from Beethoven's Third Symphony.
The nation heard the news over wire services, radio, by word of mouth, public announcement, and most dramatically, on television. Television took over our lives for what are sometimes called those four dark days in Dallas, the Friday of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, and the Saturday, Sunday, and Monday that followed. And on the next Thursday after that, the country huddled around its Thanksgiving tables, struggling to recover, which I guess we did. But after that November, we would never be the same, and neither would TV.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route.
Radio was there, and wire services, and newspapers, but it took television exactly 10 minutes after shots were fired to go on the air that day.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
That began 4 days of on-air improvisation, television's first continuous coverage of a prolonged, painful breaking news story.
It was impossible to tell at once where Kennedy was hit, but bullet wounds in Governor Conley's chest were...
There hadn't been an assassination of a president since McKinley at the turn of the century.
Thomas Dougherty is professor of film studies at Brandeis University and has written about the TV coverage of the Kennedy assassination.
So even without television, this would have been uniquely disorienting and shocking. With television, though, it becomes this indelible memory for an entire generation that with TV we can actually experience the news and watch it as it's unfolding in the same existential moment that the news is happening.
The information that we have, this is no time, obviously, for speculation.
Remarkably, it had been earlier that very fall, September 1963, that CBS had expanded its nightly newscast to a half hour from its previous program of only 15 minutes a night. NBC followed soon after.
Newscasts expanded because they had to.
Reuven Frank was producer of the Huntley-Brinkley Report in the 50s and 60s and went on to be president of NBC News.
You just couldn't get the news in. You know, we had been agitating for a half hour for a long time. With Kennedy, the television president, they thought maybe it had a shot. And it did.
And then that day in Dallas came, in quite a different technological era.
A telephone call, that's from NBC's Robert McNeil, who was with the president's party.
There was a little waiting room with swing doors, and I looked inside, and there were two payphones that were empty.
Former anchor and now author Robert McNeil was in Dallas covering the Kennedy motorcade for NBC.
And I grabbed one of them, and I kept it for the rest of the afternoon.
Bob, are you there? This is Frank McGee. Bob,
when I phoned from that payphone in Dallas, they couldn't connect me through to air.
We're having some difficulties with our communication.
And I would say a sentence, and McGee would repeat it.
The president is seriously wounded.
Which was fine for me, because it slowed me down.
The shot which wounded the president occurred as the motorcade.
In 63,
was running through huge crowds in downtown.
We were still to the point where a camera weighed, I don't know, 100 and something pounds, and a mobile unit was the size of a Santini Brothers truck.
Reuven Frank.
Our remote truck in Dallas broke down, not the television part of it, but the truck part of it, the engine. So NBC for much of that weekend was represented by a remote truck, this big, enormous thing, being towed around by a tow truck.
Obstacles, to be sure.
Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
But by the time
Central
the awful
Standard
truth
time,
was known, the networks had resolved Eastern to broadcast Standard continuously time, and remove commercials for the duration.
It was an instinctive reaction, I think. It was spontaneous and instinctive, and for the first time.
There was never any debate inside the organization about dumping commercials from about 2 o'clock Friday afternoon. We knew that you couldn't have commercials. Some people on the money side started to agitate for going back to commercials, and we just threw them out of the office.
By the end of that first day, America was exhausted and transfixed.
6 o'clock, November 22nd.
Thomas Dougherty.
The cameras are there to record the coffin being taken off the plane and loaded into a hearse, and you see this image of Jackie Kennedy. Her dress and the stockings she's wearing are stained with blood, and she's, of course, looking utterly shattered. And it seems almost this a voyeuristic intrusion into this very private moment.
The sorrow that Mrs. Kennedy and her family bear.
By Saturday, a parade of dignitaries was filing by the body lying in state. There were more details about a suspect, Lee Harvey Oswald, and reporters were struggling with the reality of a new president.
Vice President Johnson, President Johnson, I'm sure that many of us have made that mistake and will repeat it.
Nothing could have prepared TV or its viewers for Sunday.
A lot of folks would say that it is the Sunday event that is truly the one that unhinges America ever after, and that this is really when the 60s begin.
It was Sunday morning.
Reuven Frank.
And the president of NBC was watching at home along with half the country, and he was getting bored with what we were covering, and he said, "Switch to something live," he said. And the only thing we had live was Tom Pettit. Nobody really thought it was worth covering.
NBC reporter Pettit was following the prisoner, Oswald, as he was moved from jail to jail.
They switched, and there it was.
There is Lee Oswald. He's been shot. He's been shot.
CBS had had its cameras running, but they had switched to an essay at the time.
They insisted finishing the essay rather than coming to us live.
Dan Rather was in Dallas covering the Texas trip for CBS.
At a time when I was first asking, then calling, then screaming, come to us live. But decisions get made. That was an unfortunate decision. We turned it, videotape right around and played it, you know, immediately so you could say, well, really, what did it amount to? But at the time, to say I was disappointed would be a fast understatement.
Firecracker rang out. He grabbed his side and he said, ow!
Nielsen ratings have never even approached ever again. You know, the kind of, you know, stratosphere that they had on that day. Literally 93% of the American public was by a television, you know, watching on Sunday.
Monday, the funeral.
You didn't need to have people nattering on about nothing and just bloviating to hold the airspace. There was enough inherent drama in millions of people weeping over their television sets.
What did television learn from November 1963?
From then on, the presidency, it just took over the news. By the way, I don't think this is peculiar to television. I think all news media. The White House bureau's coverage expanded exponentially. A lot of people felt they had missed the biggest story of their lives. And from then on, nothing the president did or does is not covered.
I think I know before Dallas, I had no idea of the power of television to move people. It's a shared national experience.
Dan Rather.
The closest thing I had known to it was listening to the World Series on radio. And, you know, after a World Series game on radio, you could go out and everybody had experienced it. Talk about it, but that was in radio and when I was a child. At the time of Dallas, it was television. I was no longer a child.
I didn't feel my own feelings until the day of the funeral.
Robert McNeil.
We were filming, and a man came and sat down and put a transistor radio down, and it happened to be tuned to the funeral in Washington at the moment when the Black Watch bagpipe band passed. And suddenly, all my defenses and everything just dissolved, and there I was sobbing, and tears running down my face. There it was. And suddenly it just all poured out.
Television, and all of us, grew up those 4 days among those images. It was a crisis more fully appreciated by watching than by learning about. That's what television could and can do. Jackie Kennedy knew it, even that night in her bloody skirt. She'd been asked by many why she'd chosen not to change clothes. No, she said, let them see what they've done. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Fishkin.
The day of JFK's burial, another funeral was held in Fort Worth, Texas, where a small gathering committed the remains of Lee Harvey Oswald to the ground. Apart from the immediate family, consisting almost entirely of women and children, no mourners attended, leaving the task of carrying the coffin to the few assembled strangers. Those strangers were reporters present at Rose Hill Cemetery to cover the funeral. Retired Associated Press reporter Mike Cochran was one of those men, and in an article this week, he told the story of that day.
One of my colleagues from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, he said, you know, Cochran, if we're going to write a story about the burial of Lee Harvey Oswald, we're going to have to bury this son of a bitch ourselves.
You at first resisted.
That's correct. I did not want to be a pallbearer for Lee Harvey Oswald. I was very much a Kennedycrat. I changed my mind very quickly when a UPI reporter, United Press International, a friend, but very much a competitor, stepped forward and said that he would be a pallbearer. And it only took me about a half a second to realize that I couldn't let a UPI reporter be a pallbearer and an AP writer not be a pallbearer. The AP and UPI were at each other's throats 24 hours a day.
Now, Mike, one of the cardinal rules of journalism is for the reporter not to be involved in the story. In the last 50 years, how have you processed that bizarre turn of history?
I don't think any of us really thought about it that much at the time. But 10 years later, Jerry Flemons from the Star-Telegram, fellow pallbearer, he came in my office and he said, Cochran, he says, guess what? He said, I just got a call from a Chicago newspaper, and they wanted to interview me for being a pallbearer. And I said, are you kidding me? He says, no. And he says, you're going to get a call, too, because I gave them your name. So it wasn't something that we dwelled on or thought about. And then, of course, as years went on, with anniversaries, became a little bit more significant. The other night, I went to a JFK remembrance at the Texas Theater in Dallas. One of the gentlemen in the theater, he took me over to a spot, and he said, "This is where Oswald was arrested." I stood there for a couple of minutes. It was probably one of the most emotional moments in the 50 years. No, I have little good to say about or feel about Lee Harvey Oswald. It's just changed certainly my life and everything else.
All right, Mike. Thank you very much.
Well, you're certainly welcome. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Mike Cochran was a correspondent for the Associated Press in Fort Worth, Texas, in 1963. He retired from the company in 1999. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, P.J. Vogt, Sara Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, and Krista Ripple. We had more help from Megan Tian and Zach Spencer. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Ken Feldman.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. This week, go to our website and listen to the greatest hits from our new blog and podcast, TLDR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.